Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Gentlemen, to the Vinny East Show, the most technically plagued 2 hours in talk radio in the world, broadcasting live 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com from 5 till 7 p.m. Standard Time, so you catch the breakfast back from 3 till 5 p.m. Los Angeles time, and that's, of course, the Pacific Seaboard. As well, so that you can listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show when you're driving the kids home from school, minivan to your soccer practice, where you're going to, you know, dig up the playground a little bit and lay some claymore mines for the troops that are about to round you up and put you in the FEMA camps and what have you. You know, it'd be great. And also 6 till 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Speaking of Eastern Standards, you've now got some description of hurricane, I hear, heading towards Eastern Seaboard, threatening to walk out of power, and of course, every time there's some description of disaster, the president just goes, "Oh well, you know, I'm going to start protecting you now," and everybody starts to think, "He's protecting us. I'll vote for him again, even though he was a complete scumbag who completely sold us out to a bunch of banking elite mongers." My very special guest today is Douglas Dietrich from DouglasDietrich.com, and this man, holy shit. Shiite Muslim balls. Dig this. All right. We're going to be talking about a wide range of different subjects. You know how about 25% of the U.S. homeless population are veterans? And a lot of work from the Vietnam era and subsequent wars that the United States has fought false pretenses and false flags and stuff like that. Doug's going to explain why. And how Pearl Harbor was a complete sham, what have you, to get everybody into the war. Douglas is going to explain how. And you know how there's these deep underground military bases and the Department of Defense and the New World Order and the OSS, a whole bunch of things that are happening in the whole military research base thing. You know, it's all over the place. Sensor technologies, propaganda. There's a wide, incredible a stretch of information that we're going to hear out of this guy today, and it comes from the expertise, and I capitalize expertise, as a Department of Defense library researcher. So I welcome him now. Douglas, welcome to the program.
Yes, I'm having some trouble hearing you, but I think I can hear you clearly enough where I'll be able to make out your questions and the course in which we take the discussion, and that's what's important. I want to thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with the American Freedom Radio Network audience and all of the beautiful people overseas across the Pacific in the Commonwealth of Nations, to include both New Zealand and Australia. Thank you so much.
It's my job. And this is your first time on American Freedom Radio. So just I want to let you know that this network is about fun. So
right.
Make sure we have some fun today.
We'll see. Well, the lighter side of genocide is definitely an appropriate pretext in that we'll try to have what fun we can in terms of discussing the darker aspects of history, of which there are many. And so do you want to start off with the entry, with the kind of separation program, number program that you alluded to that was instituted by the United States that rendered so many American veterans homeless, Mr. Eastwood? Or do you want to start off by asking some personal questions?
I would rather start off on the personal track and who you are, and it's Arnold Schwarzenegger question. Where are they and what does he do?
No, that's great, and I can barely hear it, but I think you're asking me what it is that I do. Right now I'm with Alternative Information Media, and I'm trying to reestablish what essentially would be a fourth career in that, having gone through essentially three major careers already. One of them was a Department of Defense research librarian. I was unable to laterally transfer because there's very few civilian libraries, if any, that need an expert in documents destruction and documents incineration on their staff. Also, with the second career that I took up, which was private security mercenary enforcement, I had a lot of experiences overseas for many years, which gave me a very direct view of different cultures in the world, whereas my career before that had given me a perspective of history, which very few people have anywhere in the world, because I was dealing with documents from all over the world, including a plethora of United Nations documents that were never given to media, never given to academia. So what reality is cobbled together by academia, by media, is pretty ad hoc, and in many cases just outright fabricated. So we'll certainly go into some aspects of that. As for my third career, unfortunately, after earning about $750,000 in private security and mercenary enforcement, I came home and my parents' health was very rapidly in the decline, and I became their care provider, which took up all of my energies as their advocate, their medical case historian, what unfortunately turned out to be the terminal decade of existence. And it's only now that I'm going into this fourth career. And a lot of it is based on the kind of betrayals that my family suffered. My father was a career sailor. He was a naval serviceman for over 30 years in over three wars. He ran away from home at the age of 16. He joined the Navy. He wanted to get as far away from home as possible. And he definitely was granted his wish in this regard, in that he was sent to China and in theater China Command. He participated in the gunboat patrols to enforce Pax Americana, or the Peace of the Americas, at a time when Japan and America pretty much went to war. And that period of time was in 1937, and it was the period of time during which Roosevelt was essentially running the opium into China, having taken over the opium trade from the British Empire. And there are all kinds of politics behind this, which we can go into when you wish to. And in the interim, what had happened was that with the Flying Tigers, which were an illegal mercenary wing by both domestic and international law of the League of Nations, domestic American law, the League of Nations mandate, the Flying Tigers were basically illegal in every way you can imagine. So this fighter wing of criminals had a bomber command. They also were involved with running escort for the Chinese National Aviation Corporation. And China National Aviation Corporation, CNAC, C-N-A-C, it basically was running the opium using Douglas DC 10s and various other Douglas type of aircraft throughout China. And when the Japanese began to shoot these down and interdict the American opium trade into Asia, The Americans went to war, and they sent General Evans Fortis Carlson, a card-carrying communist who in any other administration would have been court-martialed for treason. They sent him over to China with an entire command infrastructure and headquarters unit, and he basically instigated the Nanjing Massacre by attacking the Japanese and the Chinese in the midst of their peace talks in Nanjing, the wartime capital of China at the time. The Japanese retaliated by bombing the HMS Pen A and the USS, the HMS Ladybird and the USS Pen A. And from that point on, December 13th, 1937, the United States and Japan were at war in China. So that was what my father was deeply involved with. He was involved in the Second World War in the Pacific, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War, and he got nothing for his services. Absolutely nothing of any consequence or any worth. So it's for reasons like that betrayal that I became the whistleblower that I am today, and a lot of it has to do with documents destruction in its own right. So if you want to go into that, we can go into that right away, or you can ask me some more questions you feel might be pertinent to building up a background.
Well, there was that part on Coast to Coast that I mentioned to you that I heard about the veterans and the homeless problem. I'd love you to explain why that actually is for the listeners, because it was really compelling when I heard it.
Yes, no, I very much appreciate your bringing that up, because a lot of that goes right back to my father's position, and he was very much a victim of this. And it has to do with not so much anything with the separation program number, but documents destruction concerning his personnel service and medical records. And to go into that, we should talk about the SPN number, since you brought that up specifically. All of this is a complicated series of bureaucratic maneuvers and entanglements initiated with essentially America's defeat in the Pacific in the Second World War, which takes an enormous amount of time to explain. And I would have to summarize that as in as short a time as possible if you want to go into that in this episode. Right now, let's talk about the difference between commissioned and non-commissioned officers, because it is important to the SPN number program. The Americans had 27 million men in uniform in the Second World War. They could have conquered the world. They could have just marched astride the planet with that number of men, one would think. But because Japan was arguing from a position of strength as opposed to a position of weakness, they went through several peace demands during the talk-down processes before peace was established between the Empire of Japan and the United States of America. That peace was struck at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco, where I was employed for almost a decade as a Department of Defense research librarian. That peace was struck by Prime Minister and Plenipotentiary Shigeru Yoshida on September 8th, of 1951 at the Presidio Military Base, which was the headquarters for the Pentagon of the United Nations. It was the military headquarters for the United Nations. The United Nations was established on the Presidio Military Base on January 1st of 1942, 3 days and 3 weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor, as an organization of war per Title 42 of the United Nations Charter. In lieu of the Constitution, they have a charter. And the United Nations was an organization of war that was meant to orchestrate the resistance armies behind Axis-occupied lines, meaning that every single resistance army from the Philippines to Denmark was coordinated through the United Nations military headquarters at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco. Now, the United Nations, World War II was the United Nations war, which is heavily emphasized. People on the Security Council were representatives of the five great Allied powers, the United Kingdom, France, the Soviet Union at the time, now Russia, the United States, and the Nationalist Republic of China, the nation into which I was born. And the Nationalist Republic of China now resides on, has relocated to the island of Taiwan. Through conspiracy and betrayal, the Soviet Union and the United States ultimately ejected the Nationalist Republic of China as reestablished on Taiwan from out of the United Nations. And it was mostly on the part of the United States, believe it or not, not so much the Soviet Union. And communist China was installed in its place. So the United Nations does not recognize the Nationalist Republic of China, into which I was born on the island of Taiwan, even though it was one of the founding member states of the United Nations. Now, all of this is important because I was dealing with international documents at the Presidio Military Base, and they had to do ultimately with the SPN program. during the talk-down processes with Prime Minister and Plenipotentiary Shigeru Yoshida, the United States ultimately recognized that the Treaty of San Francisco, as it was known, that would bring peace between Japan and America, went into effect on April 27th of 1952. It was signed on September 8th, 1951, went into effect April 27th of 1952. Till that period of time, Japan and America were legally at war. But Japan was making a lot of demands for concessions and reparations. One of them was the total dismantling of the Department of War, which the United States was forced to dismantle. Reconstituted the Department of Defense, wherein I was employed. They demanded the dismantling of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which the United States did. For, in 1947, they reestablished a successor organization known as the CIA. They also instituted the SPN program. This was to prevent all of these troops from leaving who were demobilizing. They were demobilizing billions and millions of men. The largest demobilization in history. They felt that the civilian economy could not handle that many men coming home. They were still involved in wars overseas that were the aftermath of the Second World War with Japan, and such as the Korean Peninsula, such as the Vietnam conflict, which at that time was known as the Indochina conflict. So they had to keep these men coming back and cycling back into the military. So the strategy for that was to make these men unemployable. So in 1947, the same year as the so-called Roswell incident, the same year as the establishment of the Central Intelligence Agency, they established the separation program, separation number program, separation program number period lasted between 1947 to 1974. And the end result of that program is that on any given day, as many as 250,000 veterans, both male and female, are living on the streets or in shelters, or at least twice that many people are going to be homeless on any given day of the year. So it's disastrous. About literally 600,000 veterans will experience homelessness at some point in their lifetime. So it's incredible. And when you look at the percentages, veterans comprise about 6% of the overall population back in 2004. And yet they were 24% of the homeless, about a quarter of all homeless. And today, of all homeless men, about one-third are vets. And they comprise, as a population base, veterans comprise about 9% of the population, but they're 42% of the homeless. So one out of three homeless men is still a veteran. And essentially half of homeless veterans are my age. Which I just turned 46, but they're about 45 years or older compared to 20% of other civilian homeless. So this is the kind of numbers that we're dealing with. The reason for that was because of a slanderous secret code.
Well, we'll get into more of this after the break. I'm aware that my audio has not kept on cutting out. So that's good. We'll be right back with Douglas Dietrich from DouglasDietrich.com, and we'll get into more of this because, I don't know, the way you treat your veterans and the people who shed their blood for you, it tells a lot about your character, I think. And if you sell them out, it's even worse. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, broadcasting live from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, the island-chained nation, and the sunny state of South Pacific. And everybody got a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb thanks to the Fukushima radiation. This helped really help the economy out and keep everybody's minds a little bit brighter. And everybody coming up with really good ideas lately, you know, mutations and such, you know, like on X-Men. One very special guest is Douglas Dietrich. Is it Dietrich or Dietrich?
Oh, Dietrich, thank you for asking. Like the actress Marlena Dietrich, to whom I'm distantly related.
The distant relations. Speaking of distant relations, you know, anybody out there listening to this may have friends, family, ancestors who served in the military, fought and died or fought and been traumatized and come back and tried to ignore all their experiences for the remainder of their life in an effort to do something positive. And that trauma gets passed on through generations. And I feel that the way a government should be treating its veterans is actually a support network. Like, let's say this. I figure if you're in combat, you essentially come out of combat needing to adjust back into normal life, right? You need to somehow get over these things that you've done. Much like in boot camp, when you're trying to get over the wall that's in the middle of the course, unless you're able to get over that wall, you have to begin the course again. And I feel what's happened to veterans is that the wall has been set too high for them and nobody has bent down so that they can jump on their back and get over it and finish their experience wholly and just kind of go, okay, that was a part of my life. It's now over. And this is only for the people who haven't suffered debilitating injuries and things of this nature. A friend of mine was telling me yesterday that Donald Trump was about to commit suicide one day. He's going over a bridge. And this homeless veteran who had been cut off at the waist with an explosion back in the day in Vietnam was wheeling himself along on a skateboard, came up to Donald Trump and offered to sell him a few pencils. And so Donald said, yeah, okay, I'll take your pencils, man. And he just gives him a whatever money he had in his thing. He didn't care. He was about to go jump off a bridge. And this homeless person kept saying, following him and saying, no, you've given me too much money. You need to take your change back, okay? It's the right, it's the honorable thing to do. And Donald Trump just, no, keep it, man. Just keep it. And he keeps walking. But this guy keeps following him. And somewhere along the way, Donald Trump decided that he wasn't going to commit suicide anymore because there are people who are suffering much worse than him and things obviously can't be that bad.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. And it's amazing the number of veterans, of course, that do commit suicide is quite high and will continue to be high so long as we have this form of ghettoization of the military, which occurred as an aftermath of America's loss of the war. That is very important for Americans to come to grips with so that they can reconstruct their society in a sane and functional manner. The entire thing about dismantling various wartime institutions that I spoke of, where the Japanese forced the Americans to open up their market, to turn over the overwhelming majority of their aircraft carriers to be remanufactured into automobiles to sell on that American market, pretty much destroyed and eviscerated American industry. And until Americans can come to grips with the fact that the Japanese negotiated this from a position of absolute strength as opposed to absolute weakness, Americans are going to live in a fantasy world, and they're going to be stuck with this human flotsam and jetsam that they have created, and they are human refuse that need to be treated as human beings. But they've turned them into human refuse by allowing the Department of Defense to destroy these people's lives. To explain again the difference between commissioned and non-commissioned officers, which is so important, my father was a non-commissioned officer. He was a chief petty officer. And all you see are homeless veterans who are enlisted men who go up to the rank of non-commissioned officer, which would be like chief petty officers, master sergeants, etc. You never see homeless officers. You don't see homeless lieutenants, homeless captains, homeless majors. The reason for this is that per the Uniform Code of Military Justice, if you're an American enlisted man, if you don't get paid, you don't have to fight. As a matter of fact, when they cannot pay you, you are not obligated to fight. Now, during the Battle of Gettysburg, at the height of the American Civil War between the states, Union generals had to go around begging hat in hand for troops to fight because they hadn't been paid in several months, and they just had to appeal to their naive belief in the validity of Union to get them to fight again. They were foolish enough to do so, and as a result, we have the United States today as we have it, basically a military junta and dictatorship, but it's a military junta and dictatorship of the officer class and the military contractors, not of the enlisted men, who are all essentially victims. And it's harder to get a job when you get out of the military than it is to get a job when you get out of prison. That is statistically a fact, and a lot of people don't understand that. Now, to clarify this again, a commissioned officer, which is why the term commission is used in the United States, has stock in the nation. Whether he's getting paid or not, he has no choice. He has to fight for the nation state. So he's invested in the United States, essentially as a corporation. So the end result is that as a shareholder, they never will experience the homelessness that the enlisted men do. Now, why did so many of them experience this? Because when you're discharged from the U.S. military, your personnel files contain a form, DD-214, Report of Separation. It summarizes your service, shows what type of discharge you received. For decades, it secretly slandered the absolute majority, the overwhelming majority of homecoming servicemen. So starting in 1947, while the Japanese were demanding demobilization, yet the Americans needed troops for Vietnam and Korea under the auspice of the United Nations. They could not legally declare war ever again. The United States is forbidden by Japan to ever do so, which is why every single war ever fought by the United States since that time has been, quote-unquote, an armed police action or, quote-unquote, an armed conflict. The United States no longer can legitimately wage war. Therefore, all of the conflicts it's engaged in since the peace with Japan on April 27th of 1952 is an illegal, undeclared, congressionally and constitutionally unmandated armed conflict or Douglas, peacekeeping action. Yeah,
Douglas, it sounds like an argument I had with my girlfriend once. I asked her, baby, why are you angry with me? She said, I'm not angry with you. I'm just really annoyed with you.
Well, there you go. You might say that this is splitting hairs, but it's the reason for the maintenance of the United Nations and why the United Nations was so important. Keep this in mind. Every single American fatality who died in the 1950 through 1953 conflict in Korea, whenever they find the bodies, and the Americans still occupy the South Korean peninsula, but whenever they find the bodies from that period of time, or even some of the fatalities that are produced to this day, those troops come home in coffins draped under United Nations flags. They are not draped under American flags. Because World War II was a United Nations conflict, this was officially emphasized even in pamphlets that were issued to the frontline troops, which still exist today that people can look up or find in antique stores or old bookstores or online. And it was emphasized throughout the Korean conflict, which was simply an extension of World War II because Korea was legally part of Japan until the Korean independence was declared and acquiesced to by the Japanese in 1945. So all of this was part of the talk-down processes, the peace processes. The end result is the Americans needed to keep men in the military. So while they were frantically attempting to stem the tide of permanent severances during the most massive demobilization in history, they would use this final piece of paperwork, the DD-214, to slander veterans with this SPN, Separation Program Number. There were 6,500 codes that were symbolized by this number that were combinations of numbers and letters, and they would overwhelmingly indicate whenever anyone looked up what the code said on that DD-214, they would overwhelmingly indicate a negative trait or behavior that would render anyone described by such terms functionally unemployable in civilian life. Now, all employers were aware of what each code meant. Job applicants who were vets were required by law to make their DD-214s available to potential employers who would then ask the Pentagon or look up the codes and lists that had been published in obscure, unclassified military documents. Even if you were a mom-and-pop store owner, you would have access to these codes. But veterans didn't know about it. And anyone who was a private business owner did. Now, the service member's commanding officer, who was commissioned, had free hand over everyone's record. Any type of discharge, honorable, general, dishonorable, other than honorable, in effect, they were affixed to everyone's records. And the CEOs, commanding officers, decided to which code to assign that would act as a scarlet letter that would follow that vet for the rest of his or her life, based solely on capricious whim, but always with the intent to force that individual's return to service. So once the existence and the purpose of the SPNs were officially admitted in 1973 at the during the American withdrawal from the Vietnam conflict, then pressure from Democratic congressmen forced the vanquishing of that code by 1974. But veterans discharged during the SPN period from 47 to 74 still have that marker on their DD-214. Now, what did those markers say? They would say things like this: admission of homosexuality or bisexuality, alcoholism, antisocial, AWOL, desertion, absence without leave, bedwetter, criminality, discreditable incidents, civilian or military, drug use, failure of selection for promotion, financial irresponsibility, indebtedness, obesity, pregnancy, disloyalty, subversion, schizoid personality, security risk, separation for concealment of serious arrest record, sexual deviant, sexual perversion, shirking, unfitness for duty, homosexual acts, unsanitary habits, withdrawal of ecclesiastical endorsement, meaning that your chaplain thought you were irreligious.
Douglas, hold on a second. That sounds like the CV of almost every American president.
Yes. Oh, admittedly, yes. If American president had all of those particular quirks, you know, it would be like he would go to the top of the list as being essentially fit for the job. You knock the heart, the brains, and the guts out of a street-walking whore, and you're left with a politician, which is essentially a mugger in a suit. But in terms of my father's own personnel records, he was discharged with an honorable discharge, and his separation program number, because he was in for over 30 years through three wars, the worst that it said was he had too many divorces. And believe me, in those days, the Navy would think that divorces were unseemly to the service and the image thereof. So he would get a demotion every time he got a divorce. My father went through about three or four divorces because no woman wants to stay married to a guy who's gone 9 months out of the year or more. So during that period of time, he would get a demotion with each divorce and then be re-promoted later. So he was ultimately discharged honorably as a chief petty officer. The problem was getting him disability for all of his medical injuries, along with many millions of other veterans whose files covered every one of the U.S. Armed Services and all of their armed interventions from the Spanish-American War of 1898 and its consequent Filipino insurrection, the Philippine-American War of Filipino Independence from 1899 through 1902, all the way through the fall of Saigon on April 30th of 1975. All of these records of millions of servicemen that would prove their injuries suffered in conflict were sent to this documentary wicker man known as the National Personnel Records Center of St. Louis, Missouri. My father's records were amongst them. And when he was discharged, back in those days, the Navies didn't have doctors. This is unbelievable in this day and age. They didn't have doctors. They had basically pharmacist mates. And pharmacist mates would often have Filipino stewards who would serve them. My father, upon his discharge, was reviewed in terms of medical health by a Filipino steward who spoke no English. And he was rubber stamped as being absolutely healthy with no injuries. So he received no benefits. He got a pension that was literally a few hundred dollars a month, half of what he earned in the Navy. And he was dirt poor. And during my course of time as a Department of Defense research librarian, I started trying to look up his records. Well, I found out they were all put, along with millions of other servicemen, into this architectural fire trap. It was a combination in construction of a grain silo and a tinderbox. The local municipal fire department protested the fact that neither fire alarms or sprinkler systems were installed, but as the edifice was on federal property, there was nothing that could be done for it. Now, the GSA, the General Services Administration, runs the federal archives. Their regional office was in San Bruno. I was given a film to destroy in my primary career as a civilian military librarian. I was able to review it first, as I was able to do with so many documents and so much footage. And this was an in-house Federal Archives agency training reel, and it exposed the fact that no less than 15 starting points of arson, inception as they labeled it, instigated the conflagration that consumed the National Record Center of St. Louis, Missouri. This entire pyre of documents went up in flames in the July of 1975, and the embers of this facility smoldered for over a month. But the Federal Archives had saved the U.S. government what today would be trillions and trillions of dollars in veterans' compensation, not to mention obscuring any historical culpability and almost too many atrocities to count as cited by those files. As an aside...
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
That sounds really interesting because, like, on 9/11, in Building 7, the offices and the floors where they were investigating Enron and all the massive fraud there were on fire. And also the Pentagon, the place where it was hit, was actually the place where all these financial records of stuff that I think like a day or two before or something, they'd lost $2 trillion or something like that. And then, boom, it hits the Pentagon and it just evaporates all these things. These people basically... Everything gets written down, and that's what I found was so strange, is that they're committing crimes and scumbaggery all over the place, and they write it all down. Why would they do that? And the answer is because they can just destroy them later if they become inconvenient.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Douglas Dietrich on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And I think we probably might even take some callers in the second hour. The number 218-239. 85252183983985. Shout out to all the people listening on the American Freedom Radio streams and in the chat room at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Back in a minute.
Around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I was just talking with the landlady outside there for a second, and her father in the British War and stuff like that. I explained what Douglas was telling me about veterans having a hard time and having their pensions cut and medical mishaps denied and keeping their medical treatment all held and the homeless problem and. And also what I mentioned about shell shock and trauma and needing to be lifted back into society. And she said, yep, absolutely agreed every single one of it, because her father was in the war. He lost two fingers on a detonator. And the exact same thing happened to him. So this is not just a United States problem that is affecting veterans. This, in my opinion, would probably most likely be a globalist system where this is happening to everybody carte blanche. Of course, non-commissioned officers only, as Douglas iterated earlier.
Right. Though, like I would like to emphasize the fact that the New World Order is not a Nazi term that was somehow co-opted by the United States and the Allies in the post-war world. The Germans during the time of the Third Reich were trying to institute what was known as a New Ordnung, or a New Order of Europe. The Americans had coined the phrase New World Order quite on their own, and this was done under the Roosevelt Socialist Administration, and this was in 1942. What I've done is I've posted a link to the map that was officially commissioned by the Roosevelt Socialist Administration in 1942 that showed the world the way the Americans wanted it to look after they conquered the world using their 27 million men in uniform. And to put this into perspective for you, the modern Chinese Communist Army, fully mobilized, complete with reserves, numbers some 4 million men. That's how much more the Americans had than even the Communist Chinese military today. So the Americans had mobilized everybody that they could. They had an enormous population. America is the third largest population on Earth, the United States is, after India and China, which have over 1 billion people each. America, inclusive of its undocumented citizens or illegal immigrants, contains 350 million people. It's the third largest nation on Earth. And it was one of the third largest nations on Earth at the time of the Second World War. And they took advantage of that manpower, put everybody in a uniform, and their objective was to conquer the world. We can certainly get into that. That is more than quite bluntly and brutally graphically demonstrated by the map that I posted on my Facebook. My Facebook can be found through www.douglasdietrich.com. So do take a look at the website, douglasdietrich.com. Douglas is spelled with one S. Dietrich is just spelled like the old actress Marlena Dietrich, or just use the words diet and rich put together, douglasdietrich.com. You can go there. You can hit the big blue F button that takes you directly to Facebook, my public timeline, and you can look at the post. It's right at the top of all the posts. You can see exactly what Roosevelt was planning. He was planning on stealing as much from his allies, if not more so, than he was from his enemies. He planned on eviscerating the British Empire, occupying Canada, the entire Western Hemisphere, stealing everything he could from the British, and basically conquering the world in conjunction with his socialist allies, the Soviet Union, creating a bipolar balance, which was America's essential balance of power for quite some time, until the collapse of the Soviet Union and the ongoing collapse of the United States military. Keep in mind that all of the military branches of service together, inclusive of the Department of Defense, which I worked for, which is 100,000 civilians, you put all that together with all of the National Guard, the reserves, all the branches of service, including the Coast Guard, you only have 2.5 million men, or people. service persons. That's less than 1% of the American population. So you've got less than 1% of the American population occupying 150 of the United Nations recognized nations on Earth. So it is an ultra power. It is Pax Americana, a piece of the Americas. It is enforced by force of arms. But at the same time, this unipolar balance of power is stretched so thin, it's going to snap like a very, very fragile sheaf of cloth. And when it smashes, it will sunder immediately. Basically, it's one of those things where they cannot hold for much longer because of the absolute dearth and lack of manpower. That's why any American concerns that are constantly pumped up by propaganda radio that we are under danger of martial law are absurd. They don't have the manpower to enforce it, even if they gathered together every single policeman, deputy, sheriff, anything you can imagine in the United States combined with the military. They don't have the manpower to take America's guns away. They don't have the manpower to put people in camps. But at the same time, take away from the idea that there's a faceless Illuminati cabal of internationalists who are running the world. It's America. Let's call a spade a spade. This is the American Empire. It is now the ultra power in terms of the world because of the collapse of the superpowers. The end result is it's an American empire. It's in collapse. There's very few men by which to enforce it. The end result is your primary concern is not martial law and totalitarian dictatorship by some new world order. It's anarchy. And so that's something that I cannot overemphasize. And who are the men to turn to in such a time? Veterans, because they've been through it and they've been living as homeless people. And there's more than enough of them. As I said, despite the fact that the military constitutes less than 1% of the American population, and of that military, very few are in combat. If you were to take the 24,500 men who are regularly committed to the front lines of combat on any given day worldwide, that is 0.00001% of the population, or such, or 0.0007% of the population. It's something like that. The last time I checked, it's literally.
So that means people don't know anybody who's probably. They know very few people, and probably have a very minute perspective on what combat actually involves. You know,
yes.
and the things that veterans go through. Now, we have a caller on the line here. Area code 713, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I've just got a food in my mouth, sorry. Douglas, and thank you so much for the show, both of you. Douglas, could you go over, we always think of when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that ended the war. Could you just explain that a little bit about why it's not there, we did not win the war?
Yes, I thank you very much for asking that, and that gets quite technical. The whole point is that the...
Okay. Thank you, I'm gone. Okay, I'll listen. All right, appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, sir.
Thanks
very
for your
much.
Call.
And so the important thing to emphasize is that the United States, in terms of dropping those bombs, accomplished absolutely nothing of any strategic significance. And that is what they continue trying to emphasize that they did. The Americans desperately had to end the war because the Americans had been heavily involved overseas in the Atlantic. They had dedicated literally the vast majority of their manpower and their resources against the Third Reich. Only 15% of all of their wartime resources in terms of both personnel and in terms of equipment went to the Pacific. And of that 15%, an enormous amount, literally one-third of it, went to the islands of Alaska to dislodge the Japanese invasion of American territory in Alaska, in the Aleutian Islands chain. And so with that ongoing, the Americans were very fundamentally undermanned, and they were going to have to take all of that manpower in Europe, and they were going to have to redeploy it into Asia. And they would have to go through the Panama Canal. They would have to go through the Cape of Cape of Good Hope, I believe. I always get it confused with Cape Horn. But whatever's at the very tip of South America, they'd have to go down there if the Panama Canal was going to be destroyed, and the Japanese most thoroughly planned on destroying the Panama Canal with their Sentoku submarines, which they had developed, and Emperor Hirohito surrendered two of them to the United States so that the United States would know exactly what he had. So the end result was they knew he had these long-range submarines that could take out the Panama Canal, and they would be unable to redeploy all the manpower they needed to deploy in time. So they were left hanging at the end of a very long logistical line strung out in the Pacific, and by the time they reached the Japanese home islands, they were very much at the end of their rope, because everything that they had been fighting in terms of that war had been overwhelmingly...
That in military history, that the story you described there seems almost exactly what happened during the Russia-Japanese War. I believe that was in late 1800s or early 1900s or something of that nature. They sent their fleet all the way around the world. It took them months to get there, and then they just got annihilated.
That is quite correct, and the reason that they got annihilated was because by that time the Japanese had completed the siege of Port Arthur, and at tremendous loss of manpower had occupied that port and turned its own artillery, its own coastal artillery, against the incoming Russian fleet. So that was the tragic logistics for the Russians. In terms of that conflict, this was exactly the same. You see, on the very day that the Hiroshima bomb was dropped, a special War Department analysis of new Japanese divisions being mobilized reached Army Chief of Staff George Catlett Marshall, and it revealed that from 1937 to 1943, the Imperial Japanese Army had mobilized an average of 8 divisions a year. Now, keep in mind, the Imperial Japanese Army was the largest source of employment in Japan. 10% of the Japanese population worked for the Japanese Army. Now, where was it? Throughout the Pacific War, over 90% of it was on the Asian mainland, not in the Pacific. All of the assets the Americans came up against in the Pacific were Japanese Marines and Japanese naval infantry. There was very few army that they ever encountered, if any, only in New Guinea. And when we get back from the break, I'll just finalize why the bombs didn't work because of this. And are we going into break? Sorry, I thought I heard some music.
We are. And I'd like to take some callers as well, ladies and gentlemen. The call-in line is open. The number is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. One more time, 218-339-8525. And we'll talk to you and take your calls after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. And I wanted to explain some of the point of the show to people. This ain't necessarily for the uninitiated. This ain't necessarily to wake people up. When I woke up, I had a lot of trauma, and I had to find out a way to cope with said trauma so that I could keep exposing scumbaggery. And I found that when I laughed about stuff, it energized me, made me capable, more capable at least, in accepting and getting over the scary elements of what we do for a living in the truth movement-ish, whatever, for lack of a better term. And this show is, I hope to provide the listeners with something that will help them think and help them cope, because it's real hard to deal with, man. Being a truther sucks, because you realize that everything revolves around scumbaggery. and there's only a certain amount you can do. And you put too much pressure on yourself. You say, I want to wake people up and do all this kind of thing. You put way too much pressure on yourself, man. Okay, it's not your fault and it ain't your responsibility. But that doesn't mean you can't take responsibility for it and change it and make it better. That's what I hope to do with the show. My very special guest is Douglas Dietrich, and we have a caller, Elizabeth, but Douglas, you wanted to finish your point there. Call in, ladies and gentlemen, 218-339-8525, 218-339-8525 to get in the queue while Douglas talks about wrapping up this Japan and the nuclear bomb scenario.
Right, and it's important. Please be patient, Elizabeth. This should only take a short while. I'm going to wrap this up as succinctly as I can so that people understand it. During World War I, the Germans won the First World War on the Eastern Front. They forced the Russians into signing the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. People can look this up, Brest-Litovsk. Litovsk. And the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk was honored by Bolshevik Russia after the revolution. And by this treaty, Russia surrendered one-third, or 33% of her population to the Germans, a full quarter, or 25% of her territories, and over half, or 50% of her industries. So Germany had won the war on the Eastern Front and was turning its attentions to the West, and at this point, the Allies knew they couldn't beat them. So when America entered the war, they used a weapon of mass destruction. They took conscripts out of San Quentin Prison right here in California where I live. They shipped them in rail cars with live, unrefrigerated chickens so that they would be exposed to all of the fecal matter as it particulated during the movement of the train. And through this, they incepted chicken roll, which led to the avian flu, the H1N1 virus. This was known as the avian flu virus back then. They incepted it on purpose, and by the time they got to Fort Lewis in Kansas, where today they built the United States Military School of Advanced Military Studies, the SAMS, which trained all of the officers who were in charge of men like myself during Operation Desert Storm. These people were trained on the basis of what they had earlier accomplished at Fort Lewis, which was the creation of the avian flu. Now, when the American troops caught all of this flu, were forced to sleep with these chickens, eat these chickens, clean the chickens' cages, caught this flu, brought it over to Europe, they wound up going to Europe in what were known as coffin ships. The majority of the American Expeditionary Forces arrived on the front in World War I dead. And they incepted what became known as the Spanish flu because they disembarked at nominally neutral Spain. The end result was that flu spread all over the world and killed 100 million people worldwide. It edged out the Black Plague in terms of its viciousness and in terms of its fatality ratio. And yet you never read of this. That's what ended World War I. That's how the Americans won the First World War. And there was blowback. 20 million Americans died. They ran out of coffins in the first 2 weeks. But the Americans had won the war. Now that was why Emperor Hirohito decided he was going to become a marine biologist and studied bacteriological warfare, which ultimately led to his winning the war. The war was not won by atomic weapons. It was won by biologicals. The Americans didn't put any stock into atomic weapons themselves. You know every single thing that happened at the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project is so open that there's one man named John Coster Mullen, who's a truck driver, who built an exact working replica a Fat Man and Little Boy. That's how open the Manhattan Project is. There's nothing top secret about it. What was top secret was Fort Detrick. Fort Detrick in Maryland was created by the Americans to create biological weapons that would kill every single Asian on the face of the earth. That's what they were counting on to win the war because they couldn't win it by manpower. Up until 1945, the Americans overwhelmed the Asians numerically. As a matter of fact, at Mackinac Island, as an example, the Japanese had 500 troops that were fighting against an entire American Army division and regimental combat teams with Grants and Shermans. But now everything changed by the time Americans got to the doorstep of Japan. At that point, the Japanese had won the war in China. In 1944, on the very day of Hiroshima, when George Catlin Marshall got that top secret eyes only report, he found out that in 1944 alone, the Japanese had mobilized 30 divisions to secure the Chinese mainland in the first 7 months of 1945, and 42 had been activated, 23 inside of Japan itself, and Japan had the available manpower to generate even more, as many as 65 infantry and 5 armored divisions by time of the scheduled American invasion. Japan had only just begun to fight, and the atomic bomb at Hiroshima hadn't killed a single able-bodied soldier. As a matter of fact, the one able-bodied soldier, General Homma, who was in Hiroshima at the time, survived.
What I found interesting is that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were actually two of the biggest Christian populations out of Japanese cities in the whole country.
Yes, but it wasn't conspiracy, it was accident. See, what happened was the plutonium bomb was much more powerful than the uranium bomb. So the Americans planned on deploying the plutonium bomb, the Fat Man bomb, over the Kokura National Arsenal. So they attacked the Kokura National Arsenal in the center of Japan, and they failed miserably. They always claimed that there was no Japanese air power to stop them. Quite the opposite is true. It's all a lie. The Japanese air power prevented them from dropping the bomb on the Kokura National Arsenal, and they made three passes, 45 minutes. They were running out of fuel. Then they found out that the fuel vein had broken inside of their plane, and Captain Sweeney was informed that all the fuel was leaking into the bomb bay, and the largest bomb in the American arsenal was now saturated in aviation fuel. So he flew home in a panic retreat and dropped it over Nagasaki, the closest city nearby. It was totally done in a panic retreat. It was totally unplanned. And because of the bowl-shaped valley of Nagasaki, the geography of the valley, it just basically wasted 80% of the bomb's destructive power. So that's why, even though it was a much more powerful bomb, far less people were killed or harmed and far less industry destroyed at Nagasaki than was destroyed at Hiroshima. As a matter of fact, underneath Nagasaki, the underground plane building facility, the Japanese were building what were known as KI-74s. These were the mass production versions of KI-77s, which were bombers that could reach New York City from Tokyo that had flown in 1941 before Pearl Harbor. So the mass production versions, codenamed Patsies by the U.S. government, were being produced by the hundreds in this facility. When that atomic bomb went over that underground plant, they continued producing at full facility, full production pace, and the 2,500 young ladies working underneath the ground had no idea a bomb had gone off overhead. That's how much of a failure the atomic bombs were. At that point, America had blown its wad. They knew they lost the war. So that's why they entered into peace negotiations. I cannot overemphasize that, and I hope that puts that in some perspective so that people understand some of what I'm speaking about. Then at that point, Hirohito threatens America with the biological weapons he had built, that he had designed personally through Unit 731, and the Americans had to sue for peace. That is the reality. Hard-hitting. And hopefully that sums it up in such a way. I'll welcome more questions, but we should probably take Elizabeth at this point, per your discretion, of course.
Mr. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Good evening, Vincent. And first off, Douglas, let me say I send you my condolences over the loss of your mom.
Thank you.
No doubt had a lot to do with the work you do. I had two quick questions. Well, actually, one, if you could get into the whole blimp, air balloon scenario, I just find that absolutely fascinating. My second quick point is I think Americans would be mortified to know half the history that you know that has been destroyed. And my last question is, what do you think the next chess move is? I mean, we've got Japan, China, Middle East, Russia. Given what you know, what is the next global chess move?
Yes, thank you so much for asking, ma'am. The next global chess move, just to put that in perspective first, we are entering a new dark age. And the dark age is going to reflect the last dark age. The last dark age was an age in which there was no such thing as politics. A man's religion was his politics. There was no such thing as Europe. The closest concept that we had to the concept of Europe was the concept of Christendom. There was Christendom. That was the closest unifying factor for that peninsular culture of the supercontinent of Eurasia. And as for the rest of the world, what we are entering is a chess game, not of politics or nation states, but of competitive religions. Basically, all of the shape and face of religion is changing, and like in the Dark Ages, a man's religion is his politics. Just as in the Dark Ages, when men lived or died on the basis of whether they were Christian or Muslim, we are returning to that period of time in history. And at this point in history, the concept of Christianity is now a Christianity with a colored face. Literally, within the matter of a decade or two, only one out of every five Christians on earth is going to be a non-Hispanic white. And the rest of the Christians on the face of the earth are going to be in Africa, Asia, and in South America. So at this point in history, there is going to be more Christians who reproduce and proselytize at the same rate that the Muslims do and actually have a higher population. And this means that the Islamic-Christian conflict is going to be a global conflict, a global war using modern weapons that put the spears, the lances, the swords of the Middle Ages to shame. And in that war, America will be a front, not a belligerent, but a front. So what Americans need to identify with is that, first of all, in this new dark age, they're not a participant on the chessboard. They are the chessboard. They're one of the parts of the chessboard over which other powers are doing battle. New religions on the face of the map, such as voodoo, which is practiced by over 60 million people in the south of the border. And that's coming up north. That will be in competition with Islam and with Christianity for the heart and soul of North America. And in this new battle, Americans need to try and reconstruct, try and establish a renaissance. The model to use would be Renaissance Italy. Just as Renaissance Italy had a collapse of a Roman Empire, which had ruled all the known world for almost 1,000 years, and yet was able to finally establish a renaissance in which they were the source for much of the science of the next age, Americans need to prepare themselves for that, survive, reconstruct, adapt to a city-state model, a libertarian economic model, a model of regionalism. Much of our population, sadly, is going to disappear the world over. Billions are going to die. But the 3%, shall we say, the average American city will probably have a survival ratio of about 5 to 30% of its former population. And with that, they can establish regional economies, regional agriculture. A lot of it's going to be within empty skyscrapers that are going to be converted into multi-story hydroponic gardens. And they're going to feed their regional populations, hire mercenary armies, private security, a lot of it based on homeless veterans who are able to be consulted into some form of functionality. And in that, that's the kind of world we're looking forward to in North America. As for the dirigibles, what Elizabeth is referring to was pretty much how the Japanese won the war by threatening the delivery of their biocidal weapons. And these dirigibles were known as arrow dreadnoughts. Basically, I have a piece of shrapnel for one of them that had been at the Roswell incident. The Americans established an enormous number of Japanese prisoner of war camps at the end of the ceasefire when the war went into ceasefire. The war didn't end, and they took a lot of these prisoners, many of whom were Korean, many of whom were Taiwanese, many of whom were Japanese, and they kept them and they never let them go home. They tortured them to death and forced them to try and teach the Americans how to fly some of these arrow dirigibles. That's how the Roswell incident took place. I go into detail on that in my DVD, Roswell and the Rising Sun, which after I produced that DVD, I did it in one day. The woman who helped me do that was the Mutual UFO Network director for Sacramento, the capital of the state of California. She was going to have me on her TV series, The UFO Connection. The moment they found out she was going to interview me, they canceled her TV series. So she helped me get this together to make this video in a private venue. We did it in one day. We didn't even have a screen. We had no advertising, yet we had the largest gathering at her Mutual UFO Network branch that she had ever had. And I came home to find my mother dying. So my mother died as a direct result of this video. Without going into the ugly details of that, that what few DVDs are available as part of a set that people can get through DouglasDietrich.com. And but the point about that is in it, I describe these arrow dreadnoughts the Japanese had manufactured for deployment of biological weapons in China. Now, China had 1/4 of the world's population. One out of every 4 people on Earth was Chinese during the Second World War. How could a nation of 100 million, Japan, go to war against over 1 billion people and win? They did through biological weapons. Emperor Hirohito was a marine biologist. He was able to deploy biological weapons in China without killing everybody because China was very regionalized. Back in the days of World War II, every single Chinese person statistically was born, lived, and died within 10 miles. So all of these nations, city-states, and warlord fortresses were so isolated, these towns, that Emperor Hirohito could virally wipe out a resistant population without infecting the rest of the population quite safely. And he used this to perfect his biological weapons technique to the point where he had developed botulinum toxin, 1 pound of which could kill 1 billion people. And he loaded tons of this onto Arrow dreadnoughts, which he dispatched to the United States after the United States had bombed Hiroshima. They reached the United States by the time that the Americans had bombed Nagasaki. And by the time they violated American airspace, the Americans sued for peace. And if it were not for that, then Hirohito would have wiped out, statistically, pretty much every American on the mainland.
Well, that's a nice place to leave it for this segment, Douglas. And I also wanted to encourage more people to call in. The number's 218-339-8525, 218-339-8525. And check out DouglasDietrich.com as well. There's actually quite a remarkable amount of information. And indeed, he's got a lot of other radio appearances that he's done on places like Coast to Coast and the like, which you can find on YouTube. And I had fun perusing those myself. Douglas Dietrich is my guest, and we'll be right back at AmericanFreedomRadio.com.
Drinking red wine and eating pizza on the very, very fabulous vista of a giant hurricane coming towards the eastern seaboard in the mafioso sense of the word. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And my very special guest, Douglas Dietrich, welcome back. The call-in lines are open, ladies and gentlemen, 218-339-8525. Yes, thank you to my very special guest announcer, Maxwell Smart. Hey, dude. You must have seen... Have you been in combat, man?
I was, but not in Operation Desert Storm, per se. Ultimately, the reasons for my dishonorable discharge probably saw more of direct violence during Operation Desert Shield, ironically, which led to my dishonorable discharge, as opposed to Operation Desert Storm itself. Operation Desert Shield, of course, commenced about 9 months before Operation Desert Storm, which basically began in January of 1991. So for the majority of 1990, 9 months, like childbirth, we were in the peninsula of the House of Saud, and we were amassing Marines. This was the largest gathering of Marines ever amassed in history, just so that people understand the realities of warfare. World War II is touted as part of this Marine Corps cult amongst the Marines themselves and to the general population. They think that the Marines had this apex of experience in World War II. The average Marine in Vietnam saw far more combat than any World War II Marine. During World War II, even though it lasted in terms of American direct involvement, proactive hostility prosecution, it lasted for about 4 years. The Marines had months in between combat, and if they survived that combat, they would be deployed to Hawaii, which is essentially a paradise for recuperation. The Marines in Vietnam had to spend 10 months, not just 9 months. And you could be drafted to the Marine Corps. People didn't understand this. You would be deployed 10 months as opposed to the average 9 months in combat, and you would be seeing combat every single day. Because they would basically use helicopter transport, mobile assault, to transport you from conflict to conflict on the Vietnamese peninsula. So the average Marine from Vietnam is just devastated psychologically by the conflicts that they were exposed to under fire every single day for 10 months, as opposed to combat Marines from the Marine Corps in World War II. Then you had Operation Desert Shield. That was the largest gathering of Marines ever because this was the most land that we ever had to amass Marines in. So we had thousands and thousands of Marines. There's about 200,000 people in the Marine Corps that were amassing. And at that time, south of our port of deployment in Al Jubail, girls' dormitory caught fire while my squad was on leave. Unfortunately, Mutavoy In unit was in the area. This is known as the Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, the CPVPV. And they carry machine guns, as all police do, in the House of Saud and throughout Southwest Asia. They also carry whips, so they can flagellate women that they find wearing lipstick or anything that are doing anything they consider suggestive. They began to machine gun the girls as they exited the building because they did not first don on their veils or proper Muslim garb, so they considered this a spontaneous incident of feminine self-display. So the woman they machine gunned blocked the exit for all the rest of the young ladies trying to exit the building, and ultimately 289 girls died. I killed two of them with my bare hands because I would have possibly killed more or had been taken down had I not been cracked on the skull by a Kevlar helmet. My helmet fell off during the struggle, and another Marine cracked my skull open with a Kevlar helmet that was still in his hands, and I woke up in a hospital with a concussion and stitches, and that's how I found out about the death of the girls. I was threatened with execution. The House of Saud formally protested my interference with domestic affairs, demanded my public execution in a public square in their territory, and the expulsion of all American expeditionary forces, which would have made Operation Desert Storm impossible. So I was the subject of a major international incident that was hushed up, and the United States Marine Corps responded first by telling the House of Saud that they would consider my case and review it while they demoted me. They needed every warm body for combat. We went into Operation Desert Storm, and I was deployed with many Marines south of Kamisaya. We went through the minefields of Al-Kuwait. When we were south of Kamisaya, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers blew the storage facilities where Saddam Hussein had maintained his toxic gas and cyclosarine nerve agent, which he had deployed against the Kurds. They blew this to hide all of the trail of receipts leading back to chemical fertilizer companies in the United States, and they exposed all of us Marines to genocidal-level nerve agents. And as a matter of fact, most of us inhaled so much of it because we had to take off our chemical warfare gear. In the desert, where it's over 110 degrees, you're wearing that chemical warfare gear that is charcoal and rubber insulated, and you're losing 17 pounds of water weight in as many minutes, and many men were dying of dehydration. So we had a choice of dying then or dying later. So we took off our hoods and we sucked in all the fumes, and my lungs have since that point collapsed 7 times. Since I was dishonorably discharged, I had no access to the Veterans Administration or any VA benefits, no military pension, no nothing. So I paid for the final reconstructive surgery, which skinned all of the blisters that had developed in my lungs and stapled my lungs to my rib cage, preventing any further collapses. I paid for all of that myself. And I was dishonorably discharged. That was the Marine way of compensating the House of Saud. And that was the story behind that. So that was my experience with the Marine Corps. Short, brutal, and unhappy. Less than 2 years. And I came back to the United States, and I went back to work for a year as a Department of Defense research librarian at the Presidio Military Base Library. They closed the library, then ultimately shut down the base in 1995 because of so many scandals involved with it. The abortive assassination attempt against William Jefferson Clinton, who at that time was a presidential candidate, still governor of Arkansas, which took place in San Francisco. Also, the child daycare center scandal, where 500,000 kids were infected with AIDS by my high school teacher, Gary Willard Hambright, who had no less than 14 charges brought against him by a federal grand jury for assaults against children, all under 4 years of age. And he himself would have been indicted for many more charges of assault against children under 4 years of age had he not himself died of AIDS while on trial. So he infected probably 500,000 kids with AIDS during that period of his reign of terror at the child daycare center. Now, all of the records for those children were in the community center, which was, of course, subject to arson and burned down in a $500,000 blaze. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the BAATF of all people, the same people who were responsible for the Waco massacre, were brought in to investigate the blaze, concluded it was arson, but it was on U.S. Army property. So the U.S. Army cried jurisdiction and said, well, it's our property. You're a different federal agency. We own this property. It's our federal property. We say it's not arson. End of story. So all the children's records concerning their rapes, their infections, were destroyed. So you see a record of arsons, and by the way, government regulations provide them the legitimacy to destroy any documents they want to destroy. They have the legal right to do so. That is why Americans know far less history than anybody else on Earth. That's why their only concept of history is a fairy tale of propaganda and lies. So,
have you noticed that the American education system, I believe history is one of the least popular subjects. And you know why, don't you? It's because they've reduced it from being about intrigue and things that matter and being able to predict the future instead into irrelevant names, dates, places, propaganda, and lies that is otherwise uninteresting.
Well, very much so. But Americans love their myths, and they love the Big Bang orgasm ending with a phallic mushroom cloud capping off World War II. Gives them this idea of they started it, we ended it. The reality was the Americans started it, and the Japanese ended it. That's why Japanese, despite Fukushima Daiichi, as terrible as it is, the quality of life in Japan is infinitely better than that of the United States. And we could go into any number of ways in which this is demonstrably so. The internet alone is 15 times faster than that in the United States, which goes through various censorship engines every time someone sends a message to somebody else. And America's internet system is almost as retarded as that of communist China's. So we have this entire delusion through the American propaganda machine, just like they exaggerated the Soviet threat. They would constantly say the Soviets have all these missiles. During the Kennedy administration, Strategic Air Command, the same men who lost the Second World War, the same men who panicked and dropped the most powerful weapon in the American inventory over Nagasaki instead of the National Arsenal, the same men came up, the same men who lost Vietnam, who when Nixon said, end this war for me, and they deployed all of their strategic bombers over Vietnam and had the functional equivalent of the 509th Bomber Group, no less than 15 strategic bombers shot down over Hanoi. These same men went to Kennedy and they told him, the Soviets have 1,500 ICBMs pointed at us on their launching pads. Well, it turned out the Soviets had four. Count them. Four. And they knew this. They knew this through satellite surveillance. They knew this through U-2 reconnaissance. And they lied. They lied to their executive commander-in-chief. They were guilty of treason. They should all have been taken out and shot. And these men ran America's economy into the ground. The entire science of business and the entire business of science was mutated to accommodate the building of ICBMs that kept a bunch of physicists, engineers, and Air Force officers in opulence. So they could all have their kidney-shaped swimming pools and their trophy wives, and every single Air Force base on Earth, every single Air Force base on Earth, by requirement, has a golf course. And nobody knows this. These are the kind of bastards that are running the United States. You've got less than 1%. You want to know what the 1% is? Less than 1% of the population is in the military, and yet they get 51%, over half of the fiscal discretionary income of the United States every single year. This is your 1%. You want America to heal up. You want the economy to rebound. Dismantle the military. Dismantle the U.S. military. I mean it. You may as well at this point, no one is going to invade the United States. There are more privately owned firearms in the state of Texas alone than there are in the entire U.S. National Guard. No foreign power is going to invade the United States to occupy it. There may be surgical moves for operational context, like the Mexicans, they invaded the United States technically during Hurricane Katrina. The Mexican army came in and helped to reconstruct Katrina, helped to restore order. You know why the U.S. government tolerated it? Because every single soldier they had was deployed overseas, and every single sailor in port, New Orleans is the largest port in the world. All of the oil from Venezuela, Nigeria, and Latin America in general, from Mexico, goes in through New Orleans. It's the largest port in the world. Has been for many, many decades. And when New Orleans was hit by Katrina and the Mexican army intervened, 20,000 sailors that were in that port deserted. They took advantage of that time to desert. And the reason why they did this was because the sailors were subject to the highest PT regulations in the world for any military. They were given physical training regulations and requirements that not even special forces need to pass. The reason why was so none of them could pass it, so they could laterally transfer them out of the Navy and put them as boots on the ground in the Iraq, so that they could dismantle bombs for the U.S. Army. They were doing suicidal work for the U.S. Army because none of them could make PT tests because they were losing too many troops, too many Army men. So they were doing this to all the sailors. So come Katrina, the sailors saw their chance. They made a break. I don't believe all of them have been recovered at this point in terms of their desertions. But no one ever hears about that. And the end result is you've got a military machine that is defeated by its leadership. It's defeated by its leadership as it has been since the First World War. You have a military machine that is being essentially decimated. That was the Roman term. Decima would mean when the emperor gave the order to kill one in every 10 men within a legion that he felt had been too cowardly or he had felt was mutinous. That is what is happening to the American military. Decima, decimation. And the end result is you want to heal this poverty. You want to help reconstruct the economy. Dismantle the military. Rely on private security forces, mercenary armies for your cities. And retreat into a city-state existence of regional autonomy, a libertarian economy, and you'll have a renaissance within days. You'll have a renaissance within decades that will make Renaissance Italy look like it had been reborn and resurrected.
You know, I think this is something people have to recognize about the military-industrial complex, is it now controls everything. So if you want everything to go back to the way it was, or perhaps transition into something that has never been seen before in all the glory, you have to dismantle the military in and of itself, don't you? But the good thing about the United States, and as the Japanese, the reason why they didn't do a land-based invasion of the United States, I believe a general or admiral famously said, I would never be stupid enough to invade the continental U.S. because if I did, I'd have a gun pointed at me from behind every frickin' blade of grass. And you have a look at anarcho-syndicalist societies that were actually, in their economy and in their social order, were working incredibly well in France and Spain. The thing that they didn't have was guns, and they got invaded by Franco or taken over by tyrannies of some kind, because although they were all peace, love, and happy and working real well together, they had no capacity to defend themselves. They had no they had no standing army, and they had no militias or nothing. They were simply lambs for the slaughter. They were free otherwise. So that maybe I think is something that could be good for America and even the whole world. I mean, we don't want to bring the world together. We want to bring the world together in a way that makes everything completely separate and free and functional and without interdependence. Because when you're interdependent, it means that your economy has been led into dependence. And if you're dependent on somebody else for your lifeblood of passion and whatever, they can just turn it off and conquer you. Okay? Learn how to defend yourself. And you've got to defend yourself on many different fronts of attack. Best way to do that is to not have too many alliances, so that if somebody attacks you, you can just attack them right back. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Vinny East will show them.
Yeah. Well, and no one like me.
The Vinny Eastwood Show, final segment here with Douglas Dietrich. Says your last chance to call in, 218-339-8525, 218-339-8525. You got a pencil and paper, write that puppy down. So we were talking about how to kind of solve all these problems and dismantling the military, dismantling the massive banking cartel system like the Fed and the IMF, World Bank, the UN. I believe it all needs to come down, okay? But come down in a dismantling format, step by step, progressively, so that the current order of the planet can be changed gradually and easily, a transition into a greater, brighter future, a united humanity that is desperate and that is separate and independent, rather than a united humanity who is simply huddling under the same boot, being crushed like cockroaches.
Well, absolutely. And the worry about a one-world empire is it's basically fallacious. You don't need to worry about that. We are the closest we will ever come to a one-world empire, and it is the United States. And I've already explained its failings and the fact that it is in the midst of very rapid collapse. Not decline, but absolute collapse. And the end result is to prepare to help reconstruct and by disparate or separate entities of culture, that competition and that stimulation will provoke the renaissance worldwide that we seek, that will take mankind to the stars. And it is this kind of culture where America has an enormous opportunity in being the first to provide a new race which will walk the earth. Cosmogonic people, people of mixed race marriage, they are fast superseding every other type of marriage within the United States. The United States has become a colony of the world. There will be city states that are ethnically exclusive. I am sure that with the breakup of civilization as we know it, you will see all white city states, all black city states. You will see many cosmopolitan and cosmogonate city-states. Imagine 500,000 Hong Kongs and 500,000 Singapores, but with the economies being ethnically based as multi-racial or multi-ethnic for cosmopolitan purposes and others that are racially exclusive. You'll see the kind of trade leagues that will develop along the Columbia and the Mississippi as the Hanseatic-style trade leagues had developed along the various estuaries of Europe. And so that is kind of a future for America. Certainly, somebody had asked in the text box about my view of God and the cosmos in general, so I'd certainly like to answer to that. I do want to bring to people's attention that one way they can have access to my articles on an international level, especially in the British Commonwealth of Nations and the English-speaking world, is through Nexus Magazine, which has been kind enough as the preeminent alternative information media dissemination periodical to have interviewed me in a Skype interview in German that was over 8 hours long with Thomas Kirchner of Nexus United Germany. And this, of course, has been translated into English and is available through nexusmagazine.com. Nexus is spelled N-E-X-U-S. Almost everybody in New Zealand and Australia is familiar with it because it sources out of Australia. But for the Americans, it's not allowed in the United States. You are allowed to subscribe, and it will be brought to your door. Or you can subscribe electronically or download the articles electronically separately, like my interviews for $1.50 each. I do not make a dime off this. This is simply to get the truth out to people. And the money goes to Nexus Magazine, of course, to support its operations. But Nexus Magazine in the United States circulated for a short period of time before it was banned from the United States, ostensibly because the Food and Drug Administration didn't approve of its alternative health commercials. The reality was they didn't want the information to get to the American people. So it no longer is allowed to be displayed on American magazine racks. So go to nexusmagazine.com. You can look for the last three issues. The current issue and the last two, and probably the fourth one, have given me an unprecedented 6 months exposure because it's a bi-monthly periodical through Nexus Magazine, and possibly 8 months if they take the rest of the transcripts into the fourth month, which hopefully is done. Other than that, I have my own radio show, Critical Omissions, and also Saturday Night Firing Lines. Critical Omissions is every Tuesday night, 10 to midnight Eastern Standard Time, and Saturday Night Firing Lines, same time, 10 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. So every Saturday and Tuesday, you can check out Revolution Radio, and this is the most feared kind of revolution that the government has ever run into, the revolution of peaceful information dissemination. They hate that. They fear that more than any other kind of activity. And it's the most attacked and hacked radio show on the face of the earth, guaranteed. Probably the only one that comes close second would be Vinnie Eastwood and American Freedom Radio. But other than that, check out freedomslips.com. It was supposed to be freedomslips.com. Freedom and slips. Just put Freedom Slips together as opposed to Freedom Slips. It's easier to remember. So freedomslips.com, and you'll be able to connect to the schedule and find out when it's on in your time zone. Once again, Critical Omissions and Saturday Night Firing Lines. The Critical Omissions, I have a guest every week, and Saturday Night Firing Lines, I just do 2 hours open calls. The interesting thing is that all the masturbatory circle jerks of these people on YouTube and these various other forums who constantly try to challenge the details of the historicity of what I cite, they never call me to challenge me on this show in all the time that I've been on. And I keep challenging them and welcoming them to do so, and they never do so. So do call in, whether you agree with what I say or not, Saturday Night Firing Lines through freedomslips.com. So thank you for that. And with your permission, Mr. Eastwood, I'd like to address some of what the people asked about what I've said about life in the cosmos and how the government came to the conclusion that there is no life in the cosmos and yet are trying to perpetuate the myth that there is life in the cosmos due to Project Bluebeam, and explain the nuances of why that doesn't detract from the reality of UFO phenomena.
We have less than 4 minutes for you to do so.
Oh, God. Well, UFO phenomena has been around for thousands of years. It's an integral part of mankind's experience. The government concluded by feeding equations concerning deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, into the Cray supercomputer in the 1980s that life was quite impossible. Therefore, the only logical conclusion is intelligent design. However, they did conclude that because life evolved on Earth millions of years before mankind appeared, that there were relic populations of life which developed here on Earth or within the solar system before mankind appeared. So we do have that, as well as descendants from the future, because time travel is what makes space travel possible. If you're going through space, you're going through time, and only by folding two points in the space-time continuum can you have an economically viable interstellar empire. So they do feel that much of the UFO phenomena that is coming to the world is either visitors of our own descendants from the future or relic populations from the past on an interstellar or solar systemic level. However, most of what happened after 1945 through 75 that left mechanical parts, that left bodies to be recovered, most of these UFO incidents are directly a result of special weapons from World War II, primarily from the Empire of Japan, and less so from the Third Reich in exile. So that would require another show to go into, but I hope that puts it in some perspective. But they know for a fact, due to Hirohito's paradigm, when he forced the Americans to sue for peace with his delivery of biological weapons, he pointed out that that the world had not been visited by extraterrestrial life forms. And he felt that we should be awash in extraterrestrial signals, because in the year he was born, was when Marconi, which was 1901, was when Marconi sent out that letter S, and that was part of an intense shell of radio noise, which by 1945 was 180 light years in diameter. So everyone knew we were here. And so his question was why no one was appearing. His conclusion was all of those civilizations killed themselves using biological weapons. Now, he was a biologist in the days before DNA. Once DNA was isolated by Rosalind Franklin and then stolen in concept by Watson and Crick, who got the Nobel Prize for it, then Americans fed it the DNA equations into the Cray supercomputer and concluded that we're not getting any other signals because there is nothing else out there. However, if we were to be able to view into the future as opposed to the past, everything we see in space goes into the past. We're seeing our closest neighbor, Alpha Centauri, 4 light years away 4 years ago. But if they could look into the future, they knew they would see a universe teeming with life that would be our descendants, which have colonized the stars. So that was a conclusion the government drew. They want you to believe there's life out there so they can tell you there's an invasion coming to get you to behave when everything hits the fan.
And this is something that Werner von Braun, who was exported under Operation Paperclip from Nazi Germany, the creator of the V2 rocket, heading up NASA during the 60s race to the moon, he said that there would be three big wars to distract people and bring about the so-called one world government, one world order, and that would be the war of cold temperatures, you know, the Cold War, and terrorism. And then finally, once that plan and scam falls over, then they'd create a false flag alien invasion. And that would say everybody would go, oh, my God, there's other aliens out there. They're all threatening to kill us. Now we are one humanity versus the universe. Let's have a one-world tyrannical government with under the complete and control of secretive bankers who knew about all this stuff ages ago but never really decided to tell us about it. It'll be honest. You know, it'll be great.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's very much the scenario. That's their last card to draw. Werner von Braun, when he was discussing this, he went into tears talking about they say they're our enemies, they're not our enemies. He was thinking of the Japanese prisoners of war who had died in areas like Ely, Nevada, Kingman, Arizona, the Roswell incident, and 20 other crashes in the western states of the United States, and thinking about how they were being tortured to death. And he was thinking of his former Axis partners, the Japanese, and those prisoners of war when he was getting teary-eyed over, they say that they're our enemies, they're not our enemies. You know, that's something to keep in mind And I want to thank you for allowing me on your show, Mr. Eastwood. Is there anything you want to say?
Well, other than the fact that you came on the show today and you taught me a whole bunch of things that I didn't already know, and it's like exhausting, Douglas, to absorb this amount of information in such a short time, and this has never happened to me on the show before. First I was bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and now it's like I have a weight of information that I now have to process. So thank you very much for that unique sensation.
Thank you.
And if you want to chat with me and Douglas off air right now, you can join in the chat room at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and pop in your Skype details there, and we'll be having a quick conversation after the show today. See you again sometime.
Yes.